Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Archimedes change the ancient world? And how did so much of his writing disappear given the extraordinary fame he earned even in his own time? Born around 287 BC in Greek-held Sicily, Archimedes not only calculated the value of pi and the volume of spheres and cylinders, he also was mythologized in his own lifetime for perfecting the technologies of levers and pulleys and for inventing fearsome weapons to defend his people from the ever-present threat of Roman invasion. And then there is that famous story of him running naked and dripping wet through the streets of Syracuse, shouting with delight after discovering the scientific value of measuring water displacement while sitting in his bathtub. Alan Hirschfeld is professor of physics at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth and an associate of the Harvard College Observatory. His new book is called Eureka Man, The Life and Legacy of Archimedes. Al, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
One of the interesting things about writing a biography about a subject like Archimedes is the fact that ancient historians were known to take quite a bit of creative liberty with their material. What evidence of his life remains from the time in which he lived?
Well, there are various sources from some ancient historians, some historians from the Middle Ages. It's not always clear who their sources were. We know that there was apparently a contemporaneous biography of Archimedes, but that has been lost. So pretty much everything that we have, which is quite limited, you have to be somewhat skeptical about what the hidden agenda was behind the biographer's writing. Archimedes, as you already implied, was famous even in his own time, and it was quite tempting for subsequent biographers to sort of keep that image burnished, and that is probably what they did. So in the end, I mean, all of my research into him, I can't really say that I know who Archimedes was. I certainly know what he accomplished, and that in itself is just incredible and reflects on what kind of person he might have been. Certainly a genius, without a doubt.
Well, let's talk about the place he came from. What was the city-state of Syracuse like when Archimedes was living there?
Well, he would be considered an ancient Greek, but he did not live in what we now call the mainland Greece. The Greeks had dispersed themselves all around the Mediterranean, so there were city-states of Greek immigrants all over the Mediterranean, including Sicily, which is now, of course, part of Italy. But his Syracuse is very, very much a Greek city-state. And the people who initially settled Syracuse some centuries before Archimedes ever came around were from the Greek city of Corinth. And so they took with them the various governmental models and, of course, the religion and some of the social mores of their mother city, and more or less transplanted it and then reworked it as the centuries passed. And Syracuse actually became one of the premier and most powerful, certainly economically powerful, city-states in all of the Mediterranean about the time that Archimedes was born, and even in some of the decades before he was born. But by the end of his life, it was quite literally just wiped out. The entire Greek sense of that city was wiped out.
Yeah, and throughout much of the time he was there, there was sort of the constant threat that the Romans might invade.
This is one thing I found pretty astounding in my research. If you look into the history of Sicily, it was populated, of course, by the native Sicilians, but also Carthaginians, Phoenicians, and by the Greeks. And there was constant turmoil sweeping across the landscape there. This is century after century with very, very few interruptions. Until you get to Archimedes, and he lived under a very politically astute king who managed to keep the competing forces of Carthage and Rome placated somehow. He was quite in the middle, both literally and figuratively, and for quite a number of decades managed to keep the peace in Syracuse and allowed Archimedes to do all of the incredible things that he did. Otherwise, he would have been running from spears, I suppose.
And I guess, Al, in the ancient equivalent of going out of state for school, Archimedes went to study. He didn't remain in Sicily. He went to Alexandria in Egypt.
That's right. One of the other city-states is Alexandria. And this was, of course, named after Alexander the Great. And its ruler established what you might call something like an institute for advanced study in the ancient times there, and collected a huge number of manuscripts in all different areas of intellectual pursuit, and also attracted a large number of scholars to interact and produce new works, new ideas, and to teach the next generation of scholars. So among them was Archimedes as a youth, presumably I assume early 20s or so, who learned his mathematics from the mathematicians who were there.
Now, there were some ancient sources that said he studied directly under Plato, but you've pretty much discovered that can't have been possible.
Yeah, there are many, many reports of Archimedes interacting with other great names, and their lives don't even overlap. So, those certainly can't be true. Whether he, for example, met Euclid, the great geometer that we still know of today, is open to question. There's no direct report. They might have overlapped a little bit while he was studying there in Alexandria, but he certainly studied under the people who learned from Euclid himself.
You wrote, or you spoke earlier, Al, about this really clever ruler of Syracuse, with whom obviously Archimedes had a relationship. Can you talk about how well the dynamics of that relationship are understood today?
Well, we don't really know all that much. That's the frustrating thing from the biographer's point of view. We have the reports, but sometimes they conflict, and even if they are in agreement, you still have to be skeptical about how accurate they were. So what we know is for sure that the king and Archimedes interacted with one another, were probably close to one another. It's certain that Archimedes was called upon to answer various engineering questions that that Syracuse might have had. It's also probable that the king was Archimedes' patron. There is a possibility, there is a report that they were distantly related, although that can't really be supported by any other report. But for sure, I guess it would be reasonable to imagine that they knew each other, probably respected each other.
Would it have been typical in that day for Archimedes to be, you mentioned the king was a patron, would he have been sort of on the payroll or probably called in on an ad hoc basis to deal with specific issues?
Well, there too, we can only speculate, but I imagine that for somebody of Archimedes' gifts, and he kept proving himself over and over and over again, I would imagine that the king would recognize these gifts and recognize more or less the necessity of keeping Archimedes happy and productive. So probably he was on some kind of royal retainer.
So he earned quite a name for himself in his day as a sort of ancient era, I guess, defense contractor.
Yeah, one thing that you see when you look at Archimedes' work is the incredible diversity of what he accomplished. We have, on the one hand, completely abstract mathematics, and then at the other extreme, you're talking about engineering and invention. And among the various engineering accomplishments were, as you said, defensive weapons. And so when toward the end of his life, when Syracuse was truly being threatened with being overrun by the Romans, Archimedes was called upon to develop the various defenses that they could use behind the city walls, and he was quite successful at that because we know, and this appears to be true, that the Romans were stymied in their attacks of the city for about a year and a half, and we can ascribe this mainly to Archimedes' defenses that he implemented to protect the city.
Tell us about the Archimedes claw.
Yeah.
This sounds like something that I always assumed that that was mythology. I didn't know that it could be proven.
Well, apparently it did exist. And there are many, many fanciful renderings by artists through the ages of what this thing might have looked like. Some of them even look very much like a human hand or an animal's claw. More likely, it was a somewhat modified cargo crane. Syracuse had a harbor. It was right on the shoreline, and they certainly had cargo ships that they had to load and unload. And I would imagine that Archimedes, with his expertise in levers and pulleys, adapted this thing. Probably he put on the end of a beam, horizontal beam, a chain with a grappling hook at the bottom. And at the opposite end of the beam, behind the defensive wall of Syracuse, he had some sort of mechanism that was operated by the defenders there so that they could, when Roman ships approached the wall from the harbor side, and the harbor waters run right up to the wall of Syracuse, when the ships actually were adjacent to the wall, out would swing these beams with their chains and grappling hooks, and they would latch onto the Roman galleys, and by some means that we are not sure of, they would lift this thing up, they would lift the entire front of the ship out of the water, shake it around, and then capsize it. And that is probably true. I mean, it sounds like it would be a reasonable adaptation of the things that were in existence at the time. But, of course, as you can imagine, this absolutely frightened the Roman Navy when they were approaching. And they also fitted out the landward walls with some of these Archimedes claws, as they call them. And, there they lifted up individual soldiers and hurled them about. So you can understand that part of the reluctance of the Romans to continue their attack was the sheer feeling of fear that the soldiers had, just at not just at the weapons that they could see from Archimedes, but the weapons they imagined were in store for them if they were to attack again. I mean, such was the power of Archimedes that he, in essence, used his mind, his creative processes, to stymie an entire Roman legion. It's quite incredible.
Alan Hirschfeld is with us. He's professor of physics at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, and an associate of the Harvard College Observatory. His new book is called Eureka Man, The Life and Legacy of Archimedes. We invite you to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email. The address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Alan Hirschfeld, who's professor of physics at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth and an associate of the Harvard College Observatory. His new book is called Eureka Man, The Life and Legacy of Archimedes. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Al, is there any evidence to suggest the story that people love to tell about Archimedes and his death ray?
I looked into that as well. There are various reports that among the defensive weapons when the Romans attacked was Archimedes' version of a death ray, essentially a giant curved mirror that would focus sunlight and project it back onto the Roman ships that were coming into the harbor and setting them aflame. This one sounds pretty dubious, and from the various professional papers that have been written today, nobody's really been able to repeat that sort of thing. It was even on, the MythBusters program.
Oh,
they
sure.
They tried to do it. A group from MIT tried to set a ship model on fire with solar mirrors, and just. You couldn't really do it at the kind of distance that the ship would have been from the mirror. But what I think may have actually happened is, if you look at the map of Syracuse, the harbor is to the east, and if the Roman ships attacked in the morning, the sun would have been rising behind them. And so it's possible that if Archimedes arrayed a series of reflectors on top of the city's defensive wall, he would have been able to reflect back the solar glare, at least, onto these ships, and making it very, very difficult for the Romans to navigate to the wall. But as far as somehow focusing that into a death ray, that seems to be fiction. Although I did find out that there was a silent movie that depicted that very scene.
What kind of method did he use, this is such an interesting story, to calculate the value of pi?
Well, let me first explain what pi is. I mean, to most people, it is just a number that is around 3, but what it actually arises from is the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. So if you take a compass and you set it to a certain size, you swing it around to make a circle. If you measure the circumference of that circle, divide it by the diameter of the circle, it will always come out to a little bit over 3.14159, and so on. It doesn't matter how big or small the circle is, this number is always true. It's a characteristic of a circle. Now, you could take a flexible tape measure, measure the circumference that way, and actually measure using a ruler the diameter and figure out pi in that rather crude way, but that would not have suited Archimedes. He was really eager to find a more analytic, geometric way of carrying this out. So what he decided was, I can't in any way measure, even in my imagination, a circular circumference. So I'm going to approximate a circle by a flat-sided figure. So what he did was he first inscribed into a circle a triangle, and then a square, and then a pentagon, 6 sides, 7 sides, 8 sides. He successively inscribed into a circle polygons of an increasing number of sides. Now, those, he could measure the perimeter of a polygon because the sides were straight. So he did this up to a polygon with 96 sides. And if you imagine a 96-sided polygon, it's going to look pretty close to a circle.
Squint your eyes and you can't tell.
You can't tell. He did the same process then for a set of polygons that would enclose, circumscribe the circle. So with these 96-sided figures, he effectively had a lower bound and an upper bound on the value of this number pi. And that number actually was then the canonical number for pi on into the Middle Ages. And, I mean, I even remember when I was in school, we used to say that pi is about 22 divided by 7. And that is one of the numbers that Archimedes actually came up with.
Legend has it that he wanted a sphere and a cylinder placed at his gravesite.
Yeah, this may be a little bit hard for, I don't know, non-geometric people to understand, but he at least is said to have valued that one measurement more than any other thing that he did in his entire career, meaning he imagined a cylinder. Okay, so let's imagine a cylindrical wastebasket, and he put into the cylinder, at least in his mind, a sphere, a basketball. So if you imagine your basketball in your cylindrical wastebasket, and the wastebasket just encloses the basketball with no space left over, Archimedes figured out that in that situation, the sphere would have precisely two-thirds of the volume of its circumscribed cylinder. From a modern perspective, you know, big deal. It doesn't really seem to resonate all that much, but to him, you know, who was looking for these kinds of numerical truths in the universe, it was quite stunning to have that being true. You know, just as the number pi was some universal number, he believed that this ratio between sphere and cylinder was also some significant universal kind of relationship. And so he then, toward the end of his life, requested that when he died, a tombstone be placed on top of his grave with a figure of a sphere sitting within a cylinder. Now, is it true? Well, we have a report from Cicero, who came some decades after Archimedes was already dead, that he searched for Archimedes' tomb outside the city of Syracuse, and in fact he reported finding it because there was this tombstone with the cylinder and sphere inscribed on it. So apparently that tale is true.
Incidentally, the invading Romans clearly would have understood what a gem this man was, even at the end of his life when they finally were able to take over Syracuse. He was not supposed to be killed by a Roman soldier.
Well, that's what we read in the reports. Marcellus, who was the Roman general, who was in charge of the invading troops, is said to have issued a direct order that Archimedes was not to be harmed. Probably recognized the value of Archimedes, if only as a symbolic captive that he would bring back to Rome. But no, perhaps they could learn something from Archimedes or use his tremendous skills at weaponry. Well, didn't work out that way, as we do know. Archimedes did die after the Romans made it into the city. So he was able to hold off the Roman onslaught for about a year and a half, as I mentioned, but because of subterfuge and spying, the Romans actually got somebody inside the city to open up the gates and just let them in. And somehow in that that rampage that followed, Archimedes was killed.
Can you tell us, Al, what you know of, if not the veracity of the famous Eureka story, of at least the significance of what that represented?
Yeah, well, you must be wondering if anything about Archimedes is true at this point. I mean, I tend to be skeptical about most of the sort of mythological-sounding reports, but what may have happened is Archimedes was given a problem to solve by the king, and I can go into that in some detail if you'd like at some point.
Yeah.
And had an inspiration about how to solve this problem while he was taking a bath. Now, back in the day, there were no individual baths. There were, of course, group baths. And so he would have been in one of these pools. And if he had had an inspiration, he may have leaped out of the bath and then quickly ran back home to work this problem out in some fashion. He may have neglected either to put on any clothes or at least to put on anything more than what we would tend to call underwear. The Greek word for naked actually could mean entirely unclothed, but it could also mean basically just lacking your toga, having your undergarments on. So that may or may not have happened, but it's such a colorful story to have this moment of inspiration so overwhelming that you more or less forget where you are and what social mores might have been, and you just rush out there and shout, "Eureka, Eureka, I have found it."
So what was this problem? The king had commissioned this beautiful, fancy gold crown and didn't quite trust the metalsmith who made it.
That's the story that we get. Now, this story comes many, many centuries afterward, but, sounds somewhat reasonable. Yes, the king commissioned a crown. Now, back in that day, a crown would have looked more like a wreath of gold. So gold leaves, literally gold leaves, that would have gone onto, a statue of Zeus. He commissioned it. He received it back from the goldsmith, and for whatever reason, he was somewhat suspicious of this goldsmith, as maybe having taken some of the gold that he was given by the king and pocketed it and substituted in the crown some lesser metal. As long as you don't put too much of, say, copper or silver into the crown, it would still look quite like pure gold. So you can't just by eye tell if it's a counterfeit crown. He then engaged Archimedes to determine whether this was pure gold or a counterfeit crown, some alloy. And of course, he directed Archimedes not to take any samples from it, couldn't destroy any part of it. Chemistry had not been invented at that time, so there was no way that they could analyze this crown in a laboratory fashion. So Archimedes decided, well, maybe I can do it this way. If you take the crown and suspend it from one end of an equal arm balance and suspend from the other end, let's say a cube of gold, pure gold, that weighs the same, okay, then in the air, those two will balance. They're equal weight. But now, if you take those two objects and you lower your balance so that you immerse these two objects, the crown and the equal weight of gold on the other end, if you immerse them both, things might be a little bit different because, as Archimedes himself knew, something that is immersed in water has a buoyant force, an upward force, and that force depends on how large the object is, not how heavy it is, but how much space it takes up. So since gold is a very dense material, if there was anything other than gold in the crown would be larger in volume than it really should be, and would therefore have a larger buoyant upward force on it than the block of pure gold on the other end of the balance. So the thing is to do this and see, does the balance stay in balance? Well, then you have pure gold in the crown. But if the balance tips up, if the crown tips up higher, then there is something other than gold in the crown. It's a little bit too big for its weight in gold.
And this understanding paved the way for everything from seafaring technologies to hot air balloons.
Yeah, the whole idea of buoyancy, I mean, now it's something that we teach routinely in freshman physics. But if you look back at Archimedes' treatises, and I could only look at translations, not knowing ancient Greek, but the translations are just stunning in their complexity. I mean, he really, really delved deeply into this problem of buoyancy and how it is related to the volume of an object. He also carried out some incredibly complex calculations on the stability of objects. That is, if you have something floating in a pool, by how much could you tip it aside until it just turns topsy-turvy? Now, clearly, that led to probably this Archimedes claw that he implemented against the Romans, because he was pretty familiar with how to tip over objects that are floating in water. So there's this sense that Archimedes just had this almost octopus-like sense of curiosities and understandings and interactions between pure mathematics and more or less pure invention and technologies. Quite incredible.
We will talk, we have a quick break to take. We'll talk more after that about the Archimedes screw. But first, talk about the device for which this thing was invented, because I was really fascinated to read about what sounds like the ancient version of a modern-day cruise ship.
Yeah, the Archimedes screw?
Well, tell us first about the craft that it was going to serve.
Well, I didn't know this until, again, I did the research for Archimedes, but they built some rather large ships back in those days. And this ship, the Syracusa, at least is how we call it, was the biggest ship ever made. And apparently it was constructed by the king of Syracuse as a gift for the king of Alexandria at the time. And it had all sorts of wonderful accessories to it, and among them was this Archimedes screw, which could be used basically to bail out the bilge if any water leaked in.
Okay, let me stop you right there.
Sure.
We'll get more from that story in just a moment. Alan Hirschfeld is my guest. His new book is called Eureka Man, The Life and Legacy of Archimedes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is professor of physics at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth and an associate of the Harvard College Observatory, Alan Hirschfeld. His new book is called Eureka Man, The Life and Legacy of Archimedes. If you'd like to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Al, you were starting to tell us about this Archimedes screw, which was essentially invented as sort of a bilge pump.
Well, it may have previously been used as an irrigation device. The whole idea is it's a corkscrew, an enclosed corkscrew, and you put the bottom end of the corkscrew into some body of water, and you crank the thing, you turn it around its long axis, and water seemingly miraculously climbs up the screw and pours out the upper end. So Archimedes may have invented this thing while he was in Alexandria. They still use it to raise water up from the Nile and pour it into the fields on the banks adjacent to the Nile.
It's pretty amazing that it is still in use today in all kinds of different systems.
Yeah, I mean, I've discovered some pictures on the internet of Archimedes screws being used in waste treatment plants to, well, get water from a lower level to an upper level. It's a very, very efficient way of doing this.
Okay, I want to talk now about the loss of some of his work. First of all, who would have possessed or wanted copies of Archimedes' work during and soon after his lifetime?
Well, that's part of the problem. He was so advanced for his time and so specialized that in his time there were just a handful of people who could really comprehend what he was doing. And these were, by and large, the fellow scholars in Alexandria. After his death, still, there were people in Alexandria who were interested in his works, but unlike somebody, say, like Euclid, who essentially wrote a textbook of geometry that everybody had to read, and therefore there was great, great call for reproducing his manuscripts, Archimedes was more of a specialist and did not appeal to a wide audience. And that's very risky. You know, when you're talking about an ancient manuscript or series of manuscripts, and it's wearing out, you know, quite literally dissolving with age, somebody has to be interested in copying that thing over. Otherwise, it will just, you know, quite literally dissolve into dust. So there came a time, probably around the year 1000 AD or so, when there were very, very few Archimedean manuscripts around. At least in the original Greek, there were a number of Arabic translations in the Arab world. But in terms of original Greek, I mean, the language that Archimedes actually wrote in, by the year 1000, there were, as we can best piece it together, about three compilations left over, all in one place, in Byzantium, which is now in Turkey. And it's kind of almost frightening from a scholarly perspective to have such great works in such jeopardy that they might not make it into the modern era. Now, this is certainly something that is true not just for scientist mathematicians like Archimedes, but playwrights and philosophers as well. I mean, there's much, much that has been lost of these ancient works that we know about, but we don't have the works themselves.
And given that lack of recognition of the value of the text, there were people who assumed that literally the paper that it was printed on was worth more than the content.
Yeah, well, you know, when we talk about paper, you know, I have to be a little bit careful because they didn't introduce paper into the Western world until probably, I guess it was like 1300s or so.
The parchment it was printed
parchment,
on.
Yes, parchment. In my book, I actually write about the invention of writing, the evolution of writing, and of writing materials. You know, one thing that we certainly take for granted is that there's plenty of stuff that we can write on. There's paper everywhere. And, you know, back in the ancient times, writing surfaces were not all that common. You could write on a broken shard of pottery. You could write in the sand or in the dirt. You could write on a tablet of wax. But in terms of, you know, permanent writing with ink, you had papyrus. You had also animal skins, parchment. So the documents of Archimedes were written on parchment, very, very expensive materials. And so if you had a sort of a spare parchment document that you didn't really care about, you washed away the ink. You reused the parchment. It would be as though you had just 10 pieces of paper to write down everything, and you know, you ran out of space, so you would start erasing some of the old things that you recorded. And they did the same thing in monasteries all in the Western world. They erased the ancient documents from the parchment and recut and reused the parchment for newer documents.
And this is called a palimpsest.
A palimpsest, yes.
So you have these scribes and monks sort of slaving away. What was copied on top of the Archimedes palimpsest?
Well, the Archimedes palimpsest refers to one of these three compilations I mentioned before in Byzantium. Mm-hmm. It was a collection of seven of his treatises. And then around the year 1229, we we know this now with great certainty, that material was erased, not quite completely, thankfully, and it was overwritten with a religious text, you know, basically a manual on what prayers to say during various holidays in the Greek Orthodox Church.
So this remained in obscurity until 1906?
Yeah, just about then. A little in the late 1890s, it sort of surfaced, but really came to the fore in 1906. It came to the attention of what was then, I guess, the world's foremost Archimedean scholar. He heard from a colleague that there was this strange palimpsest that was in the city of Constantinople at the time, in a monastery there, and that it was a fairly standard religious text, but underneath, very, very faintly underneath, incompletely erased, was mathematical writing. And the colleague sent this Archimedean expert, Heiberg, a sample of the writing. And Heiberg, who was intimately familiar with Archimedes' work, he knew the particular dialect that Archimedes wrote in. It was rather unusual at the time. And he knew also the complexity of what he was looking at, this ancient writing. It really pointed to somebody with the skills of an Archimedes, if not Archimedes himself.
So given the technology available at the time that Heiberg was working, how much could he actually make out and read?
It's kind of amazing how much he could read. Heiberg was based in Copenhagen. He traveled to Constantinople to take a look at this document and confirm that the writing that was incompletely erased underneath the religious writing was indeed Archimedean treatises in the original Greek. And he then proceeded to copy it out as best as he could. Time ran out, so he engaged a photographer to take pictures of the pages that appeared to have writing on them, and then he took this back to his office. And when you look at his translation of this ancient writing, it's absolutely remarkable how much he could see with his magnifying glass and his eye, because if you look at these pages, you barely see anything at all. It really is quite a ghost of writing that is there. It speaks to the stick-to-itiveness, the commitment of Johann Ludwig Heiberg, that he actually spent year after year just trying to piece out this ancient writing.
Now, these days, experts will take a work like that and they'll look at it with ultraviolet light. What difference does that make?
Well, even in just the couple of hundred years between the original Archimedean writing and the follow-up religious writing, the ink formulation was a little bit different. So that if you, say, shine certain wavelengths of light onto the page, the different inks, the mathematical ink, you might say, underneath, and the overlying religious ink will fluoresce, but fluoresce to a different extent, and perhaps in a slightly, slightly different wavelength. And so you can image the page and effectively tone down the writing you don't want to see, the obscuring religious writing, and bring up in contrast the writing you do want to see, the underlying writing of Archimedes, and see much, much more than you could with just a straight look at the page. So they use, as you said, ultraviolet light, and they also placed these pages in a very, very modern X-ray machine that bombarded the page with high-energy X-rays, causing the underlying mathematical writing to fluoresce.
And the palimpsest now sort of resides with a private owner?
It does, yes. It had sort of an interesting 20th century existence. As you mentioned, it came back to light in 1906, And by 1920, in the confusion of, in the wake of World War I, it disappeared, only to reemerge in 1998 when it went on auction at Christie's. But there it was purchased by an anonymous owner. So or at least I don't know who he is.
But that owner funded the modern-day research on this.
He did. He paid more than $2 million for the palimpsest itself. And I have to say, I mean, the book itself, it's a very small and rather ugly-looking book. So the value is in its contents and the symbolism of what is contained in there. But he paid $2 million and then funded the modern-day research that allowed scientists to probe more deeply into the writing and essentially almost completely reveal every bit of writing that is in there. And so with these new, this is new information. And remember, this was in the original Greek. So this is probably as close as you could get to Archimedes' original writing and intent. And so it really allowed us to gain a clearer window into what he was thinking at the time and how advanced his thinking truly was for his age.
Al, I imagine it's fun for you to imagine what else might be out there.
Yeah, well, there certainly are other manuscripts that are lying on shelves in ancient monasteries and ancient libraries around, and I'm sure that others will come to light.
Do you have a favorite myth about Archimedes that turns out to probably not be true?
Well, let's see. Well, he is said to have single-handedly launched a ship, a fully loaded ship, from dry land into the harbor. And there are some old depictions of this that show him sitting sort of comfortably in the ancient equivalent of a lounge chair, turning a little crank and moving this gigantic vessel into the ocean. So I imagine that there may be a kernel of truth to that, but it's probably not quite as easy as they depict in these figures.
Alan Hirschfeld is professor of physics at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth and also an associate of the Harvard College Observatory. His new book is called Eureka Man, The Life and Legacy of Archimedes. Al, it's been so interesting. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.